Christine, congratulations. You are currently a writer on the Huffington Post. You have an article right now on the Huffington Post.
It's true. I have been made a contributing writer for the Huffington Post. It's
what is the name of this article?
I think it's contributing blogger. I can't even say it. The point is blogger. Now I can submit things to the Huffington Post, and perhaps they'll be published, and perhaps they won't. But I do have one now.
Yes, that you can read.
You can read right now. It's called Let's Talk About Rape. How clear is that?
Let's talk about rape. Okay, I'm sorry. You said let's be serious this time, and I go into a musical number. But
it is a serious rape.
Like people, and I believe the point of your article is that people, it's one of these things, people don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
And that makes it so much worse. It's like child molestation. It's like, I think some things are just so horrible to contemplate that other people will do them, that people don't want to think about that it's possible people will do them.
Right.
So they don't even want to talk about it.
And also, I think for a lot of women, it's just something you question in your mind. Is that what happened? Did that happen? Did I let that happen? Why did I let that happen? How did I let that happen? I should have screamed. There's just so many scenarios, and nobody talks about it. And if we just put it out there and just talk, not just women to women, but everybody,
yeah,
women to man to woman, everybody should just be, it should be an open conversation. It's like, if I take your money, Hannes, I just committed a crime, okay?
Yeah.
You had money, and I took it from you.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, if you violate my body and I say no, that's a crime.
You're right.
So it's the same
right.
thing.
Right, it's the whole thing where it's like, oh, well, she was asked for it. She was wearing a skirt. And it's like, and people do the same thing. Let's say that I wore like a, you know, $600 Rolex and a really expensive suit, and I walk through
the worst
neighborhood. Yes, yes, you would, because you enjoy watches. But I walk through the worst neighborhood in L.A. at midnight, and I get robbed. Somebody's going to say, well, you know, you shouldn't have done that. It's like that. The fact that I'm, you know, it's not my fault. You still don't have the right to steal. Like if I leave something in my car that's visible, and, you know, then they break the window and they steal, they say, well, you shouldn't have left it be visible. It's like you still don't have the right to steal it.
Right.
Just because you saw it. My
personal.
You can't
invade somebody's space like that.
Right. And it's like my personal pet peeve, which makes it sound very small, is the imposition of anyone's will onto someone else.
Yes.
I hate that. And rape is the most extreme version of that, but there's a million versions of it.
That's exactly what I'm talking about, yeah. Hannes. That's exactly what I'm talking about. So hopefully with this article, more women, more people, everyone will start talking about rape. And I'm really excited to now be a contributor to the Huffington Post. So
folks, head on over
to the Huffington Post and search Christine Blackburn. You'll find my article. Let's talk about rape.
Story-worthy media. The best in story-driven content.
This is Alex Stein from No Mr. Bond, I Expect Your Dreams to Die, available on Amazon. And you are listening to Story-worthy because you're great.
Welcome to the Story Worthy Podcast. Here are your hosts, Christine Blackburn and Hannes Finn.
Welcome to Story Worthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm here with
Hannes Finney, and we're coming to you from the original Playboy Mansion on the Gold Coast of Chicago.
No, I'm not familiar with this.
Yes, this is the original Playboy Mansion. The reason in the 70s, Hef used to divide his time between here and the Mansion West, which is in Holmby Hills, California. But
the Holmby Hills one. I've been
right,
to that
well, that's
one.
Become,
the
well, yeah. Yeah, this is the original. Because you realize Playboy started in Chicago.
No, I didn't realize that.
Yes, yes. There used to be a building in downtown Chicago with the Playboy logo on it. No, it started in Chicago and then came out here because he left Chicago permanently after being hassled over some alleged cocaine use by Illinois Governor James R. Thompson at the original mansion. So it was the 70s. I'm sure it was fine.
So you're telling me Hugh Hefner moved west because of a drug charge?
not against him. It was just sort of the governor of Illinois was supposedly had done cocaine at the original Playboy Mansion outside Chicago.
And he wanted Hugh Hefner out of town? What do you mean?
No, I think Hugh went, I'm just going to leave, go to some hep place where, you know, I can do whatever I want. And now, look, he's 110. He has 12 girlfriends. And he is, you know, is it cocaine or is it his urine at this point?
Because it's so dry. I went to a party at the Playboy Mansion here in Holmby Hills. But not inside the mansion. It was like outside.
Oh, you didn't get to see the grotto?
It wasn't inside. No, the grotto is outside. Oh. No, I saw that. I was in the grotto.
You were in the grotto? I'm never drinking out of your cup again.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are here. I guess that's why we're here in Playboy Mansion, because our guest tonight, Alex Stein, brings forth the topic, dating multiple people at a time.
Yes, and so that just makes me think of
Hugh Hefner,
Free Love and the 70s
and
Playboy, multiple girlfriends, and that sort of behavior which would take place at the Playboy Mansion, no matter where it was located.
I actually did see Hef out and about here in Los Angeles at... it was the Amundsen Theater or something, and he was with all his girlfriends, and it really is a funny sight. Have you ever seen that?
I've never seen him in person, no.
It's really humorous because all these girls, their hair is all the exact same color blonde.
Yeah.
It's not just blonde. It's, like, very specific, and they're all pretty much the same height, and they almost are. It's
they
almost
look
like
almost
they're
exactly
uniform.
The same. Yeah.
Yeah, they're, like, in a uniform, and they know they are.
Yeah.
It's like they're walking around in Halloween costumes.
They are. They are literally, that is the slutty Hugh Hefner girlfriend. That is the new one. The slutty nurse, slutty witch, and slutty Hugh Hefner
slutty
girlfriend.
Slutty girlfriend.
Yeah. The, I'm trying to think. At the Amundsen, I once met Shirley Jones.
Yeah, okay. There you go.
Which is not exactly the same as Hugh Hefner, but it's the
you
best Amundsen
story.
You
always said you liked Mrs. Partridge more than Lori Partridge.
Oh, no. I would sleep with Shirley Jones today.
Wow, interesting.
First of all, she was gorgeous.
Yeah.
Still gorgeous.
She is still a beautiful woman.
And also, as I've said before, like, I don't want to sleep with Barbara Walters, but if she offers, I have to.
Yeah.
Because, Barbara, like you said, you'd sleep with any president on a coin or
that's
a
true.
Bill.
Anybody on
you
a
have
coin
to.
Or a bill. Yeah.
You have
well, there's,
to.
If there's a story to be had, there's a story to be had.
Right, exactly. I mean, I can think how many podcast appearances I can make with I Bang Barbara Walters.
Now, listen, speaking of Shirley Jones, she's married to Marty Ingalls. And one time I saw him, he was speaking at like a luncheon thing I attended. This is like 20 years ago in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
And he had on white pants, okay?
Yeah.
And he had sat on a Tootsie Roll.
You hope.
And he got up, and he is walking toward the podium, and there's Marty Engel with a Tootsie Roll on his white pants. And that's all I know about Marty Engel.
But anyway, Marty Engel is a crazy old-school comic. For
maybe
all
he
I know,
planted it.
He's in Pittsburgh, and he's like, what the fuck? I used to be on TV all the time. You know what? I'm going to make this interesting for myself.
Maybe
somebody get me a Tootsie Roll.
maybe
now
that's
chew
exactly
it,
what happened.
And now stick it on my ass. I'm
all right,
going
you
up
guys,
to the podium.
So listen, dating multiple people at a time. I'm very surprised we haven't talked about this before.
Well, we haven't as a topic. Your stories of dating multiple people.
I used
people
to date multiple people all the time.
Yeah, yes.
Because I had this problem,
up.
This guilt thing where I didn't want to let anybody down. So if somebody wanted to date me, I would say sure. And then I couldn't break
then,
up.
But then you would end up letting them all down.
Then I let them all down.
My psychiatrist because, voice.
Right. I almost had to have like a chart in my room in college, like a door in my dorm. My dating schedule was more complicated than my classes.
Yeah, I'm sure you paid more attention than you ever did to calculus or anything that was going on there.
Yeah, I did nothing in my own.
Yeah, I was
ridiculous.
Never that guy. I can't do that. I mean, I you know... I could never do it. I was thinking about this coming in here. It's like I was okay. You know that joke? I'm like a lesbian. You know the joke, which is what does a lesbian bring on a second date? A moving van.
A moving van.
You never heard that?
Yeah, I've heard.
I was always more like that guy. It's like sometimes I would sleep with somebody in college, and I'd be like, "What are we doing next week?" And she'd look at me like, "I just needed to bang somebody. What are you?
Yeah,
get out of my dorm room. What are you doing?" I was never the guy who was like just running around and had to, you know, be with a whole bunch of
dating multiple people at a time. The problem comes in not only the lying, but the omitting of things. So you're kind of there's these
lying
lines
by
of
omission.
Right, exactly. And
passive
so then
aggressive
in the
lying.
End, if other people find out, or you know, you're trying to juggle all these this stuff going on, and you're lying, then. you just end up being like a horrible person or a bitch or like an asshole, whereas the person who did all those things just ends up feeling guilty. I mean, if you grew up Catholic, like me.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you know what I mean? So it's kind of like if my with my daughter, I would certainly encourage her not to – you can date multiple people, but there has to be a clarity.
Well, your daughter is not by blood but by some heir, my niece, and I need her to join a nunnery. I don't want to have any, you know, in 15 years or less, I don't need any like, hey, Uncle Hannes, I'm dating this guy. His name is Victor, and he's a biker, and
Here's the thing, he owns a tattoo shop.
It's like, I'm going to kill him.
The main thing is I want her to know that she can say no at any time to anybody. So just because somebody would show you affection or want to do nice things for you doesn't mean you just can't say, no, thank you.
But you do realize the reason you quote unquote couldn't say no is that you were craving replacement effectorin from your dad who had left and you didn't see him for 7 years.
Blah, 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 blah.
But see, now I make a sentient point because I have been trained. I've never been trained in any way, shape, or form. But by life, I realized that that's what you were trying to.
No, I know that now. But I think that the story where the audience and people that follow our show have heard about my, you know, the difficulties.
They like to point at their, well, I was going to say radios. They like to point at their iPhones and laugh and laugh.
Speaking of which, folks, if you'd like to support the Storyworthy podcast, that would be great. Hannes, you know what's been picking up lately?
Patreon.
This is an ongoing campaign that we have for people that want to help us support the show.
It is.
So people support us by giving us $2 a month, $5 a month, $7 a month.
Some people even give
$25 a month.
I know.
Which is really wonderful.
It's awesomeness.
But it really helps us out, and it gives us the encouragement to push on.
Right, exactly. And it's not, we're not making a ton of dough.
Well,
this diamond ring I'm wearing was not bought with Patreon money.
It gets us closer to shooting a pilot, which is what we really want to do.
Making the show into even more of what it can be.
Right. In other words, a visual presentation and television would be nice, wouldn't it?
Television? What is this television you speak of?
No, anyway, I want to go backwards.
I want to go into Telegraph.
Also, folks, feel free to follow us on Twitter at Storyworthy. And you know we're on the Instagram now, Hannes. I'm on Instagram at Storyworthy.
At Storyworthy is on Instagram. I'm on Instagram well at HannesPH. And I put up several interesting photos.
You are very good on Instagram. I will say that.
Because I received for Christmas a tablet. I have jumped into
it's
the 21st
anus,
century.
Which is freaking
it's called Asus. It's ASUS. It's a British company.
And it says, sent by my anus. And I'm like, I can't take this. You need to change it.
Right. And by the way, well, I have no control over that.
It's a custom thing. You just go in.
Okay,
I'll change
I can
it
get
for
rid
you
of
later.
By the way, here's what I really hate because it's so much more sophisticated than my computer. By the way, it's more sophisticated than my computer, and it has better video and audio than my television.
Yeah.
And I'm playing solitaire on it most of the time. But I tried it, like I sent you an email and I was putting the word hooker was in the email.
Of course it was. Well,
no, of course
well,
it was.
This is the normal email.
And it auto-corrected to like boomers. The next day I looked and I'm like, boomers?
I saw that.
But of all things, I mean, first I hate autocorrect, but how did you get... It's not even the same first letter. Where did you fucking asshole,
listen,
autocorrect?
Just go in the settings, and it's all going to be worked out in the settings. You just have to spend time with
your devices.
I'm busy
with solitaire. I can't be setting
things.
You
just have to spend time with your devices. That's all I'm saying.
I got
to
spend time with my anus? Is this what you're saying?
All right, you guys, hang tight wherever you are, because our guest, Alex Stein, is on his way here. Next time on Storyworthy, we have author and voiceover artist Bill Ratner.
And I'll be talking about my new book from Familius Publications, Parenting for the Digital Age.
That's next time on Storyworthy.
Hey, Hannes, my new book, Pit to LAX, My Storyworthy Life, is coming out March 25th.
Yes, and I have seen the pre-copy, or what is that called?
It's called the proof.
It's fabulous. It looks gorgeous, of course, designed by Carolyn Brunetto. It looks fantastic. It's a real book. It's got pages and words on it.
Thanks very much. And it's actually, I'm getting a lot of positive feedback about the book, and it makes me feel really good, because I thought at first, like, I didn't have a story about coming to Los Angeles, but that is the story, because there are so many people sitting in their hometowns.
It's a bunch of stories
that want to come to Los Angeles and they don't do it.
And they don't have to have come to Los Angeles. They just need to have gone somewhere else.
Yeah, in other words, breaking out of your comfort zone and pushing forward and being optimistic and trying your best. So head on over to storyworthymedia.com and you can pre-order the book right now. It's only $10, $3 shipping and handling. I will personally sign it for you. And the first 100 people that buy the book get a free gift. How about that?
Hey, it's Jennifer LaFleur, and you're listening to Storyworthy.
And we're back. We have left the original Playboy Mansion outside Chicago and traveled up to the original first Playboy Club. Where do you think that is?
At
Lake Geneva, Wisconsin.
Woo, woo, woo.
That is, in fact, the first Playboy Club in the history of, and there's actually none left.
Do you remember those Playboy Clubs? You know, the emblem was so iconic, and I do remember seeing it on the top of buildings, like Atlantic City, of course, and like you're saying, Chicago, and I think it must have been here in Los Angeles somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, well, no, the Playboy Clubs were a successful chain for quite a while when it was, you know. But I have to say, it was probably considered sexist at the time. But compared to Hooters, I'm guessing the Playboy Club was a pretty classy joint.
Yeah.
Yeah, these girls, they kind of had sort of a sexy outfit, but geez, they were really covered up quite a bit, actually.
Yeah, compared because they had on like the tuxedo shirts or whatever.
Well, they had like, yeah, the bunny outfit, but it kind of, you know, compared to these damn kids today.
When you just said bunny, Hooters, you had this look in your eye like, ah, the bunny.
No, I just went, in my head, I just went back to being 12 years old.
Yeah.
And the, you know, that when you see, it's like, I'm such a weirdo that you would sneak in to see your dad's Playboys. But eventually, you know the joke? Oh, I read it for the articles. Mm-hmm. Eventually, you would read the articles.
You would read the articles.
No, eventually, yeah. And be like, oh, here's our, you know, here's our thing about our Playboy Club in Wisconsin. I was like, oh, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
You know, because I'm a big fucking Wisconsin nerd.
That's awesome.
I'm like, should be busy masturbating. I'm 13, but I'm reading about it. You know, I think that my state needs more publicity.
All right, you guys, he's here right now. Alex M. Stein. He is a writer and he's an award-winning documentary filmmaker whose Iditarod movie, Mush, is considered the best movie ever made about the last great race on Earth.
I would like to see that. I like the Iditarod. I love that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fabulous. I want to call this episode Iditarod. We're going to turn this whole thing around.
Okay. So even though he's not going to talk about that, we're going to call it that because Iditarod is podcast gold.
No, but later on, I do want to ask about it. I'll say that.
No, yeah, we'll want to hear about that.
He's also a master storyteller here in Los Angeles. He produces a weekly show down at Muse Literary Salon. Have you ever been down to Muse on 8th?
I don't believe that I have. I know of it, and I've driven past it, and I always think I should go in there.
It's a really good space. It's a creative space. This woman named Jennifer owns it, and it's just like she's supporting the creative arts, and it's just like a shot of adrenaline in the middle of Los Angeles.
Yes, in the original sense, or the French sense, not a hair salon.
You can also find Alex's essay collection, No, Mr. Bond, I Expect Your Dreams to Die. It's available all over the world on Amazon.com. It's available in a physical and also a digital form. And you can contact Alex at alexmstein.com and also find him over on Twitter at coldfootfilms. All right, folks, wherever you are, put your hands together for Alex Stein.
Yay! Thank you, guys. I'm also, I should mention, I'm not on the Instagram because I don't have an anus.
Great. Buried the lead. All right ahead.
I dated 4 women in a row named Suzanne, each crazier than the last. The first Suzanne was tall, skinny, and blonde. When she was 10, her brother died in a house fire. Her takeaway from that event was that life is random and horrible and at best something to be endured. Her parents were dour conservatives who drummed it into her head from a young age that sex is never to be enjoyed, but is random and horrible and at best something to be endured. Needless to say, our sex life was abysmal, although I had nothing to compare it to, so I thought it was great. To say that she would just lie there like a dead fish is frankly an insult to the many fine dead fish you people have probably known and perhaps fucked. I am not here to judge you. When we broke up, the first Suzanne angrily said she'd never had an orgasm with me. What I should have said was, of course not. That might require you to be an active participant. But I didn't. Instead, I said the first thing that popped into my mind, even though it didn't make any sense, which was, well, I never had an orgasm with you either. She started to argue with me, and then something fantastic happened. I could literally see the doubt enter her brain and move across her face, and she looked up and to the left, searching her memory bank to see if it was at all conceivable, no pun intended, that I had never had an orgasm in the 2 years we were together. And maybe I knew that nothing either of us could say would change anything, or perhaps I just instinctively recognized a dramatic and memorable exit line when I heard it, but whatever the reason, I turned and walked away, never to speak to her again. And it is a sign of my own personal failure as a human being that to this day, I take great pleasure in that conversation. The second Suzanne was a short brunette with great curves. She grew up in Maine and told me she remembered where to exit the Maine Turnpike to get to her parents' house because the exit number was the same as her breast size, 38C. And I don't remember a lot of things from my junior year in college, but I remember that. And unlike the first, the second Suzanne was enthusiastic in bed and would come like a freight train, and not the steady taking goods from the factory and delivering them to the hardworking Americans in the Midwest type of freight train, but the kind of freight train that barrels down a steep mountain, shaking violently from side to side, threatening at any moment to derail and kill us all, which is a lot more fun than the dead fish thing. Although, again, I'm not here to judge you. The second Suzanne had an imaginary friend in India and would frequently cock her head to the side and listen intently, describing in great detail what her Indian friend had just said or done. I found this endlessly endearing, at least until her Indian friend told her to rob a convenience store. He then refused to testify on her behalf because he's imaginary. And when I suggested that he hop on an imaginary plane to fly over, she said I was being hostile. And I guess she was right because I could not stop myself from saying, at least I didn't rob a convenience store. The third Suzanne was a redhead with beautiful green eyes and would kiss like a push-me-pull-you from Dr. Doolittle, alternately drawing you in and pressing you away in some sort of hypnotic, erotic dance. We broke up when it became clear that we had different ideas about monogamy. She thought she was still being monogamous if she fucked other guys, but only guys she'd already fucked so that her number wouldn't go up. After we split up, she got pregnant with her next boyfriend and had an abortion. And then she was furious when the clinic wouldn't give her the aborted fetus to take home. Oh. They give you the worn tires when you get new ones for your car, she told me, and then wouldn't listen when I said, most people leave their old tires at the shop, and besides, there are no religious zealots protesting outside the Goodyear. The fourth Suzanne was a rocker chick I met at a Pixies concert. She had hair that was six different bright neon colors and sexy tattoos and fun places. And we'd fooled around a couple of times, but we hadn't slept together. And then I helped her move one weekend because I'm an idiot, which oddly is spelled the same as nice guy. To thank me, she took me out for pizza because that's what you do when you're in your 20s and someone helps you move. Over pizza, she said it was sweet of me to help her. And part of me died inside because I've always believed that when a woman calls a guy sweet, that is a secret female code that means I am never, ever going to have sex with you. But I want you to keep deluding yourself that it still might happen because I like having you around and I do eventually want to end up with a nice guy. And I'm pursuing that goal by making sure that I only fuck assholes. The next Friday, I got a call on my landline, or as we called it back then, the phone. It was the fourth Suzanne, and she said, I'm at the phone booth across the street from your apartment. Come have a drink with me at the bar on the corner. And this was back in the days before cell phones, when there were still phone booths. And I thought this was weird, not because I knew somehow that one day there would be no more phone booths, but because I'd never told her where I lived, and my address wasn't printed in the phone book. So the only way she could have known where my apartment was is if she'd followed me home from work, which seemed kind of creepy until I remembered her sexy tattoos and I said, I'll be right down. At the bar, the fourth Suzanne started telling me in great detail about a 12th century demon named Nicalthic. And I thought to myself, she's quirky and funny and soon she's going to reveal that this is a big joke and we'll both laugh about it. But instead of getting to that joke, she kept telling stories about Nicalthic and the enemies he had battled, eviscerated, and in many cases, eaten. And I kept staring at her tattoos, which began to seem less and less sexy. And finally, after an hour, I said, so are you trying to tell me that you worship demons. And she reached out and tousled my hair as if I were retarded or a puppy or a retarded puppy. And she said, first of all, it's demon, singular. And second, we prefer the term celebrate, not worship. And then she grabbed my collar and pulled me into a ferocious kiss, which under the circumstances, given what we discussed, could only mean that she was literally trying to suck the soul out of my body and not in a good way. And I pulled back and told her that I didn't think things were going to work out between us. And she started to purr and said, Nikalthik will miss you. And I grabbed my coat and she added, totally as an afterthought, and so will I. And as I walked back to my apartment, I vowed then and there never to date another Suzanne. Quick postscript. Years later, I met an amazing woman not named Suzanne, and we had an instant rapport. The first time we met, we talked for 6 hours. And during that talk, I told her the story of the four Suzannes, each crazier than the last, which up until that time, I had never told anyone. And we grew close and eventually slept together. The first night we spent together was at her apartment, and I got up in the middle of the night to use the bathroom, and I bumped into her bookcase and knocked her college diploma to the floor, and I was trying very hard to be quiet and not wake her up, and I picked it up and put it back, and I looked at it, and I saw that her middle name was Suzanne. So naturally, I started looking for signs that she was crazy. And if you've ever had a vague pain at 2 a.m. and looked on WebMD for bizarre diseases that could cause that pain, and then the other symptoms of those bizarre diseases, you know that once you start looking for this stuff, you always find it. Things went bad in a hurry, and we broke up after a shouting match in the parking lot of an Applebee's in Western Massachusetts. She harangued me with a laundry list of complaints that were entirely about her and involved me tangentially, if at all. And at the end, all I could think to say to her, literally the only thing that entered my mind, was, why didn't you tell me your middle name during our first conversation? You don't hide shit like that from people. What's wrong with you? And she looked at me as if I were the crazy one and said, I knew it was a mistake to date another guy named Alex. And maybe she knew that nothing either of us could say would change anything, or perhaps she too instinctively recognized a dramatic and memorable exit line when she heard it. But whatever the reason, she turned and walked away, never to speak to me again. And it is a sign of my own personal weakness as a human being that I let her go.
Here's the question. Did you guys eat at Applebee's first, or did you just go there to break up?
The intent was to eat at Applebee's.
But you never got into the restaurant?
So you lucked out because you didn't have to eat at Applebee's.
And it was Western Massachusetts, so.
Yeah.
So how old were you when you were dating all these women?
I was in my 20s, my early 20s.
So out of college?
In college and just out of college.
So just to be clear, we may have got the... So you dated them sequentially. You weren't dating them at the same time.
Yes.
So, okay, we were incorrect about that.
So you were it's more like dating multiple people with the same name over a period of time.
Right. Yes. It's like dating one person named Suzanne who gradually goes off her meds over the years and becomes crazier and crazier and develops different personalities. That's the way I'm.
And different hair colors.
And different hair.
But oddly, none of them were the same color as at the Playboy Mansion.
Oh, exactly.
I see. Yeah. Do you ever see anybody breaking up in a parking lot or just having a big fight, like in a parking lot, like Applebee's or Chili's or Fries?
Yeah. Like one of the person, either the woman or the man, will be really like
irate.
Losing it. And the other one is just like, cool it. Would you just, we're in Trader Joe's. Could you just bring it down just a little bit?
I find that very funny. I know it's not funny, but I think it's very funny.
Oh, it's hilarious.
I would think it would be different, too, depending on what store or restaurant you were outside.
Yeah.
Like, Fries would be a very, very different argument than Chili's.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. Right. Right. Trader Joe's and John's Market. These are two different. John's Market, the argument's in Russian.
Yeah, it's two different arguments.
And they're screaming. By the way, this is the weirdest. I don't know why you just made me think of this. There's a Burger King in Glendale. Right, which is a genteel kind of place. And I once saw two middle-aged men, anywhere from 35 to 45, in middle manager kind of like ties but no jackets and suit pants, obviously on their lunch hour, and they got into a physical brawl. And it's the funniest fucking thing you've ever seen. Like two out-of-shape white guys
In suits, especially, but
not suits.
Uh-huh.
They weren't in suits. They've like, you know, it was like you go to Ross and you get the shirt and the tie in the same box.
Yeah.
They were wearing those things, and they're like, but it's not in the
movie. Did they actually make contact, or did
no,
just
they
sort
didn't,
of
but
like
what happens is that, they, yeah, in the movies, it's like people are throwing punches, and it's dramatic, but in real life, it's just two fat, pasty white guys kind of wrestling.
Flailing.
And neither one of them wants to give up, but neither one really wants to commit to hitting the other guy, because then he's going to get hit
did
in the face.
Did they end up on the ground?
Yeah, they're rolling around
it's
on the ground
so
in the parking
funny,
lot.
Honest.
It's noon, and I'm just looking like, this is the funniest fucking thing I have ever
that
seen.
That is really funny.
Because I know it's going nowhere. They're
talk
not
about
gonna,
being on Instagram. That
yeah,
would have been a great
nobody's
going
to knock you. They're not knocking somebody out.
Yeah.
And nobody's really fighting, but they hate each other so much they couldn't. It's amazing.
Note to self, go home and register Pasty White Guys Fighting in Glendale.com.
Yes, exactly. That's where all the big money is. Here's so this is great. I mean, it's funny because you were talking about looking for crazy in the line. See, the thing is that in one way or another, everybody's crazy. So you can find it.
Mm-hmm.
No matter who you're talking to, you can find the crazy in somebody if you're determined to.
Mm-hmm.
So,
see, I'm looking at you, Alex Stein, and I don't even know you very well at all. But I'm thinking to myself, you are a very creative person. However, you majored in college in economics and the philosophy of religion.
Which I am prepared to argue are actually the same thing.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. Economics and the philosophy of religion. So it seems like you've got the, like maybe this straight-laced side to you. So you were going after these women who were kind of, you know, a bit on the crazy side because, as I understand, they're better in bed.
That is true. Yes, crazy women are better in bed.
I've heard that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so in other words, you could have stayed within your field. You know, you could have dated another woman who maybe was
an
economics
economist.
Major. Right.
Oh, have you seen economics majors?
Well, this is where I'm saying. So
I should not have said that, but yeah, there it is.
Okay, well, there it is. So when did you get interested in documentary filmmaking?
I got interested in documentary filmmaking about 10 years ago, and it was something that I fell into. My wife was...
is her name Suzanne, by the way?
It is not. It's Amy. My wife Amy was in a Grammy-nominated vocal band that has been around for now 35 years.
Oh, wow.
And they were at
Mannheim
the time...
Mannheim Steamroller?
No, the Bobs. And they were getting ready to celebrate their 25th anniversary. And I said, someone should do a documentary about them. And they all said, yeah, that's a great idea. Someone should do that. And then, of course,
you should do that,
nothing,
Alex.
Nothing happened. And I realized, oh, wait, that's someone who should do that is probably me.
Right.
So I did that. And similarly with the Iditarod movie, there were aspects to the Iditarod that I found out about that were just endlessly fascinating me. In addition to it being a grueling and larger than life 1,100-mile race through gorgeous scenery where it's, you know, sometimes 70 or 80 degrees below zero, there's all sorts of traditions and things that happen around the race that don't really get very much.
So, okay, I really want to know a lot about this race. But first of all, why did you even go there? How did you go to Alaska?
I've been kind of obsessed with Alaska. I felt like Alaska is calling to me for for most of my life.
Oh, wow.
And in
is
fact,
that right?
Amy and I were married in Alaska above the Arctic Circle at the northernmost saloon in the world by the bartender.
Is that Santa Claus? That's
no.
Wow, that's amazing.
That is actually awesome.
How long
you know
been
what
married?
Happens in the Arctic Circle?
Stays
in
the
Arctic Circle.
How long have you been married?
We have been married now for 19 years.
And how many people were at that wedding in the saloon?
There were the bartender who married us. Because in Alaska, you can be married by any adult resident of the state.
Sure.
that's awesome.
That's unbelievable.
This is how the interview is going to go. I'm going to say these things that you think are weird but intriguing, and then we'll never get to the actual question. And then we had his wife was there, who was a columnist for the Fairbanks Daily News Minor and wrote a big column
that's
about
weird
our
and
wedding.
Intriguing.
And,
so it's basically like you got married in Northern Exposure. It's like that tiny little...
And then we had our two witnesses were these people that we met at a rest stop at the side of the road 4 hours later who then walked into the place where we were getting married.
Did you tell them to walk in or that was a coincidence?
No, that was a coincidence.
I thought you might say they were sled dogs or something.
That would be cool.
Okay, so you have this whole thing with Alaska and so then somebody decided somebody give you money to make this documentary, or you just went and did it?
I just went and did it. I was trying to raise money, and I had a certain amount of money that was that I thought I was going to get, and then it fell through at the last minute. And this was in the sort of depths of the Great Recession. And I thought, I can wait another year and try to do this next year. But I didn't know, at the time, I didn't know that the economy was going to be much better, and I didn't know that I would be able to get the money. So I thought, okay, rather than going to 15 places and having a big crew, what is the least amount of money that I can spend and still go to the places I need to go to and do most of the stuff myself and get what I need to get? And that's what I did.
And that's what you did. So how many people? Was just you and one other person, or just
mostly you? It was just me.
And did you contact the people racing in the Iditarod and say, hey, man, I'd like to come along? Or how'd that work?
How it worked is I had contacted a bunch of mushers who were
mushers.
Running the race.
You don't hear that every day, do you, Hannes?
No, you don't.
You do around my house. So I contacted
dirty.
Ooh, hello.
Filthy.
So you learned that from Suzanne number 3.
Yeah. So I had interviewed a bunch of mushers the previous fall, and then I came up and I shot a bunch of stuff at the start of the race. I shot stuff in the middle of the race, and I shot stuff at the end of the race.
So explain the race. Tell us how many people and what do they do.
So the Iditarod was the modern Iditarod was started in 1973 to celebrate dog mushing in Alaska. And in part to commemorate the diphtheria serum run in 1925, where
that's a party. Yeah.
Yeah. So we'll never get to the answer to this question.
No, I know.
So we
that's what this whole show is, meandering.
So in 1925, there was an outbreak of diphtheria in Nome. And at the time, they didn't have enough antitoxin. And Nome was a much bigger place then, so there were 20,000 people there. And they had antitoxin in Anchorage, but at the time it was very hard to fly from Anchorage to Nome. So they decided that what they were going to do is take the antitoxin by train up near Fairbanks and then do a relay team of take it by relay team of dog sleds to Nome. And so they took I believe it's almost 700 miles in a little over 100 hours. Wow.
700 miles in over 100, so like 5 days.
No,
4 days.
Like 4 days, yeah.
4 days. Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And then how did they decide to call it the Iditarod?
That's
Iditarod. That's a race. That's right. The race.
Right.
Iditarod. I do remember hearing
this story.
But
is it the name of a town?
It is the name of a town that is now abandoned that is on the Iditarod Trail, but it's also an Athabascan Indian word that means far distant place.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that. I dated a guy once named Rod, and I did a Rod. That,
oh, hello.
That's not true. That's not going anywhere. So tell me then, how long did you actually go with them on the race? I mean, did you go along in a snowcat or a snowmobile or something?
I didn't. I want to do that, but I wasn't able to get the money for that. So I did stuff around the start. With the Iditarod, there's a ceremonial start in Anchorage, which all of the TV stations cover, and that is filled with pageantry and weird traditions, and it doesn't count at all.
Yeah.
And then they restart 100 miles away the next day.
I see.
I've seen that. I've seen the pageantry and the thing, and I saw, I can't remember, it was one of those British TV shows where they I think it was Stephen Fry, I think. He went to every state in the United States. It's a really good show if you want to see it on Netflix. Anyhow, so I think it was him. And there's a guy who spends... He's got like a hot dog cart in the lower 48, but he spends like 3 weeks a year in Alaska around the Iditarod making like moose burgers and bacon wrapped hot dogs and
cooking
shit.
For them.
Yeah.
And, you know, like just people who are there to observe. And he makes so much money that he can almost just live on it for the rest of the year.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Answer your question from before, there are teams who enter the Iditarod, and it's one musher and up to 16 dogs. And you can drop dogs at checkpoints, which means that you leave the dogs behind and then they're flown back to Anchorage, but you can't replace any dogs.
So, oh, wow.
So the
Why
16
would you
dogs
want to drop
you,
one?
For example, sometimes dogs strain muscles or aren't doing well or aren't getting along with other dogs. So then you don't want to have them on your team because they would slow
you down.
It's not
like a weight thing. It's their behavior.
Yeah. Their behavior and training. And each year there are – usually there's been between 60 and 100 teams. So at the start, you can sometimes have – you usually have
2,000
like,
dogs.
Yeah. Between 1,000 and 2,000 dogs.
That's fascinating. Now, what month is it run, by the way?
It's run in March.
In March. Now, I did dog sledding in Breckenridge, Colorado. They have a dog sledding place, and it was exhilarating. I mean, I couldn't believe how wonderful it was.
It's really amazing, and the dogs are so well treated and so well cared for.
Well, they want to run. All they want to do is run.
And when the mushers pull the hook, the dogs
fly. Yeah, they
and
fly. They just want to run
most
ahead.
Magical things
I've
ever
experienced. It's like they're lurching forward.
Mm-hmm.
Are they part reindeer, Alex?
I don't believe so.
I don't believe so. Can I just
say
that? I think
that's illegal in most states, maybe not in Alaska.
In Alaska, you can marry a reindeer as long as a child marries you to the reindeer. It's a little known facet. I was just going to say, I'm sorry, what was it, 2,000 dogs? Here's what I'm thinking. Somewhere around April,
yeah.
There's just how many dog turds are there
on
the
trail?
There's 2,000 dogs running through the.
And it's all frozen land.
You think
land,
the guy's
right?
picking it up to add weight to his Iditarod?
Yeah.
You know, no.
I don't think Iditarod's the name of the sled.
One of my favorite quotes that's in the movie is one of the mushers I interviewed, Sue Allen, said, people think that it's really glamorous, and there's a little bit of glamour when you come down Front Street in Nome, which is where the race finishes. But she said, you know, the other 50 weeks a year, when you're cold and you're miserable and you're out there scooping poop, there's no glamour in that.
But that's like any long-term goal or run. You know, it's like marathon run, you know, running a marathon or doing any kind of a race or, there's longevity.
Putting together a decent podcast.
Yeah, producing.
Exactly.
I mean, in other words,
there's so much more poop involved in this than you would ever think.
I mean, the glory is always, the icing on the cake for me is when I'm sitting in front of a guest because I've already done all my pre-production and then I got to do the post-production later. So it's always like in the moment, of course.
Right.
Of course, coming into the finish line right here. You know what I mean? Listen, because I haven't talked to really anybody on the podcast about Alaska. Have we ever talked about Alaska?
I don't think that we have, no.
Here's what I have to ask you. I want to ask you about, do you remember the documentary with Timothy Treadwell, The Grizzly Man?
Yes.
Grizzly Bear Man or whatever?
Yeah. Directed by Herzog.
Werner Herzog.
Werner Herzog. What do you think about that guy, Timothy Treadwell, his experience with the grizzlies and the way he led his life?
There's an expression that a lot of people in Alaska use, which is Alaska always wins.
Mm-hmm.
And what that basically means is you can come up and you can think that you've got a handle on things and you can have like a little bit of mastery over things that are controlled. But ultimately, when you're dealing with the great outdoors, and I'd extend that to the, you know, wild animals, there's a limit to what you can do. I don't doubt that he had a real bond and a real ability to communicate with these animals, but I think that his faith that would stop them from being essentially bears was fatally misguided.
Well, there's a food chain, isn't there?
Yeah.
The footage he got, though, was unbelievable.
Yeah.
His footage is stunning.
Mm-hmm.
See, I just realized what it is they were like, oh, you're one of us. They're like, oh, you're one of us, which means you're a bear. And then when he wouldn't act like a bear, they'd be like, oh, I guess I'm supposed to eat you because you're not one of us. It's like they're not going to be thinking about it like, yeah, but you're my friend. It's like there's
friends. It's like that old parable about, is it the scorpion and the frog or whatever? And the frog gives the scorpion a ride across
the river.
And then the scorpion stings him and he's like, I'm a scorpion.
Stings him and they both go down and they're going to drown. And he says, we're
so
both going to drown. Why'd you do it? And the scorpion says, it's my nature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so Hollywood too, you know?
and you know, it's like we can, you know, we see this sometimes with domesticated animals, you know, like dogs and cats, and we're friends with them, and we think of them as being human, but they're not. They're still animals, and maybe they're not as wild as bears, but you know, sometimes with your dog or
Treadwell,
your cat.
Yeah, Timothy Treadwell was an interesting, you know, obviously his demise in terms of, you know, he sets up this camp with his girlfriend, and you know, there's pictures in this documentary. You see his camp, and you see, and then all of a sudden, you know, gone. In the morning. He just got attacked and then it was gone. But
so what always drove me crazy as a young man who was finding it hard to talk to women and all that, I'd look at that guy and go, that guy's got a girlfriend? He's out in the middle of the fucking woods. He's having sex with bears.
Speaking of which, Alex, where were these tattoos in funny places? What are the funny places?
Not funny, haha.
No, funny, intriguing. I'm not someone who has a lot of experience with tattoos, so I always think that tattoos, and you know, it's like in hidden places.
Like the license plate? Are you talking about the tramp stamp? What do you?
No, you
the
know,
license
like,
plate.
You know, like, the lower back tattoo.
No, I get them. I've never heard that in my life.
No, like elbows and knees and
you know,
ankles.
If you see somebody with rings around their elbows, that and stands for how many years they spent in prison.
Does it?
Don't date those. Yeah, don't date those.
And if you have,
I thought that was only true about trees.
No, teardrops on your face, the number of teardrops, the number of guys you killed in prison. No. So if you say, no, I'm not. So you see a guy with three teardrops tattooed on his face. Well, first of all, just stay away from that guy.
Yeah.
And second of all, he's killed three people. So.
Well, I've always thought that it's much more intriguing and sensual to have things that are not as obvious. So I'm not talking about like tattoos that everyone would be able to see, like neck tattoos or lower back tattoos. I'm talking about things that are mostly hidden, and then when they're revealed, it's like, oh, hello, look at that.
A man told me that he likes cutouts in clothes, right? Because there's like a little cutout of skin exposed that you didn't expect you would see. Have
Is
you heard
this
that?
A straight man? Just
let me ask you this. All right, you run this really great show here in Los Angeles at Muse Literary Salon. What's the name of the show?
The name of the show is Muse Literary Salon, and the venue is Muse on 8th.
Oh, so it's too many Muses.
Muse on 8th?
No, I'm kidding. Okay. The point is, you have some great storytellers, and just here we're on a storytelling show. What do you think, Alex Stein? What do you think makes a good story?
I think it's a number of different things. First of all, like anything, we want our stories to have a beginning, middle, and end.
Mm-hmm.
And you can play around with the form a little, and you can have the, you know, you can come back to the beginning, or you can have the end be in the middle or whatever. But you have to have like a very solid structure to it. The other thing is you have to take people somewhere where they haven't been before, or show them something that's unexpected.
Mm.
And since I've been running this show, and also just for the past few years when I've gotten very involved with the storytelling community, I've seen a ton of storytellers at a ton of different shows. And, you know, there are a lot of people who treat being on stage at a storytelling show as if it's therapy. And it's really not. It has to be entertaining.
Right.
You know, it has to have some artistry and art to it. And I had a conversation a few weeks ago with a storyteller who had told this story that, first of all, wasn't about her. It was about something that she was present for, you know, but it didn't involve her, and there was no real arc to it. There was nobody was changed or enlightened or learned anything or was entertained by anything that happened. It was just a series of events. And I said to her, that's not a story. And she said, well, I think anything that happened, you should be able to talk about. And I said, sure.
You can. Yeah, sure.
To your friends.
To your friends at a bar.
Yeah.
But not on stage.
Well, what you say about therapy, it's like, of course, that happens if you see a stand-up comedy show, too. It's like there are people who just are like, It's harder than it looks to like take your problems or your weird obsessions and turn them into a routine that people want to follow and laugh at. It's like just talking about things that occur to you just because it made some guy laugh when he said it the first time. But that's not a joke. It's not a routine. It's not a
storytelling doesn't. You don't have to break somebody down to build them up to tell a good story. You know, it can be a win-win. It doesn't have to be like you have to bare your soul and make sure that I know that you suffered in some way to make this worth my while.
Are you kidding? What about all that poor sex he had to have with those crazy women?
Simply the suffering.
You know, my other pet peeve, if I can just mention it, is people who get up at storytelling shows and the first thing they do, either physically or verbally, is apologize for their story. And it's like, oh, this isn't very good, or I didn't have a chance to work on this. And all I can think of is then get off the stage because I want
to
feel like...
Yeah, you're telling me you're wasting my time before
you
waste
here?
Right. Yeah. I want to feel like... you are worth listening to. I want to feel like what you're going to tell me is something that is going to be really important and really have an impact on me. And if you're already telling me that that's not the case and that, you know, you're apologizing for what you're about to do, I'm making lists of what to buy at Ralph's.
And you're making me see. And again, there's obviously, and they're very similar, but there's a component of that in stand up and the non-face. See, I like it when you said it's also going to be non-verbal. It's like there's a physical thing. If somebody comes up and they have their notebook and they just slowly are turning the pages, it's like you couldn't be bothered to memorize 3 minutes of material, and you couldn't be bothered to even like take all the, if you have to have notes, you could have like taken the notes and like written them down on a new page.
Or just have a set list. Like,
just have a set list.
Or at least
but it's like,
turned
hang on
to the correct page.
And then you're like, hang on, let me look. You do one thing and then you're like, hang on, there's another thing I wanted to say. Page. That's not it. Page. Wait, I got to go back. Paper. It's like, I'm watching you turn pages. This is Matt. You're telling me my time is worthless.
I was at a stand-up show a while ago, and this guy came up, and he had a notebook, and he was leafing through it, and for a very long time. And at first, I thought maybe this was a bit that he was doing.
Like an Andy Kaufman kind of a thing?
Yeah, he was leafing through it, and then finally, he looked at something, and he just let out this enormous sigh. And I laughed harder than I had laughed at anything else that night. And that, like, totally threw him. And then he went into the bit, which was awful.
Yeah.
And I just thought, your sigh at your displeasure with your own material cannot be the strongest thing in your set.
No, but if he had left, he would be like, that guy is fucking brilliant.
Exactly.
Madison Perry was on the show recently, and he said that something that he finds that storytellers, where they might make a mistake, is they get on stage and tell a joke first thing. Because if the joke fails, we are already in a very bad place with you.
Right.
You know what I mean? So you're digging yourself out. So don't start with a joke.
Well, and also there's the whole thing with the moth, and I have kind of a love-hate relationship with
everybody
the moth.
Everybody does.
But one of the things that bothers me the most about the moth is people get up on stage and the first two words they say are almost always, so. Yeah. And I think, no, you know what your first line should be. Stop that. Just come up and say it.
And the last line. You should know your first line and the last line.
Yes.
And on that note, do you want to play some Shotgun Story Worthy?
I do. It's what I live for.
It can only mean one thing. It's time for Shotgun Storyworthy.
The game where our storyteller spins the storyworthy wheel of truth and tells a true one-minute story about the topic it lands on.
So everybody, say it with me.
Spin that wheel!
Break up. You know, I think that the best way to break up with someone is if you tell them right away that you are never going to break up with them. If you tell them that the best thing that has ever happened in your life is to meet them. If you just drown them in praise. And when I was 16, I was trying this method out. And I had a girlfriend. And she was a little bit rough. I was a straight-laced guy. I wasn't in the chess club because there wasn't a chess club. But if there had been, I probably would have been. And she was always telling me, well, you know, my friend so-and-so just got out of prison. And I said, oh, I don't have any friends in prison. I'll have to borrow some of yours. And we finally broke up because she told me that I was just not tough enough for her.
Wow. That's crazy, man. Really?
I was hoping not to have a breakup, not to have a relationship thing since
I thought you might talk about breaking up in the parking lot of Applebee's.
I feel like I already told
you. Yeah, you did. I like to see that your ill-gotten relationships with women started early. Ill-gotten
is the wrong word. What should a woman say? You go out with a guy and you do like him, but you're not that into him, and he's not going to get in your pants, and you already know that in your head. If you're a woman. And
you know that within 3 seconds.
You can say to the guy, we shouldn't say, but I think you're really sweet. You can't say I'm sweet. If I say you're sweet, then...
So here's the thing. All of my female friends tell me that that is not how women use the word for sweet.
Oh.
And yet all of my male friends say, yeah, that's exactly how they use
the word. Let's have the conversation.
Okay.
Alex, I've really enjoyed spending time with you. You know, I think you're really sweet.
I don't have to take the shit. I'm out of here.
And that's the breakup?
I don't know.
No, that should be, but it never is.
It never is.
Because the guy selectively hears. He doesn't hear you're like, yeah, I went out with this guy last week. It was fantastic. And I told him about that thing that you told me about the movie.
Uh-huh.
And thank you. It was really sweet of you to tell me that. And all he heard was, you're sweet. That's all he heard.
Wow.
It's like the guys are always, well, women do it too. They can, you know, these women who like date some asshole, and it's like the guy's abusive, but he does one thing where he doesn't hit her that day, and he opens the door once.
Or he brought me
And you're
this,
like, so. He opens the door for me all the time.
He brought me juice.
So we selectively
he brought me juice
choose
after
the
putting
nice
me
things.
In the hospital.
It's complicated. You've never been divorced?
No.
Well, good for you. I'm just
You've been married 19 years.
Hey, listen.
You had such shock in your face. It's like, wait, certainly you've been divorced
kind of
three or four times.
Listen, where can folks find the Iditarod documentary?
Mushthemovie.com.
Mushthemovie.com. I love it.
Okay, I'm sorry. That sounds like, again, like some perverted, like people squishing bananas with their bare feet and getting off on it.
And listen, my book, Pit to LAX, My Story Worthy Life, is coming out. And we're going to do like a book thing, a release at
the Muse Literary Salon.
I would love to do that.
Ooh.
And I'm going to get different people to read the stories. I won't be part of it. It'll be about the book, but I'll just be looking
you'll
over
just like, you'll just be in the back looking at us like, you did that wrong.
Right. No, it'll be like lurking. The Kennedy Center Honors, where it's like, here's Paul McCartney and here's Steve Martin and Tom Hanks, who you'd like to see them do something. No, they're not. Here's a guy who's going to do one of Paul
That's
McCartney's
exactly right.
songs.
And I'm going to sit in a big chair off to the side, and I'm just going to be present.
Even cut out
now,
of President Obama.
I am looking for the equivalent of Heart doing your Led Zeppelin song.
Oh, I'm so into that. That would be fabulous. That's exactly, that's the music that should be behind me, for sure. Hey, listen, thanks so much for coming on today. We really appreciate it.
Yes,
thank you so much for having me.
All right, we're going to wrap it up. I'd like to thank everybody here at Sideshow Network, especially Maria Spertolozzi.
Maria Spertolozzi!
She's such a great girl and looks so fabulous in this new year of 2015.
She's got a new hair. She's got new hair.
Fantastic.
She's still got the bouncy ball chair.
I'd also like to thank Sean Merrick, of course, and John Thomas Griffith. He wrote our theme song.
Have no idea who that is.
And on behalf of our storyteller, Alex Stein, and of course you, Hannes Finney, my dear friend and co-host, my name is Christine Blackburn, saying, make it a story worthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the Story Worthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Story Worthy on iTunes and visit the Story Worthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.
If you like listening to comedy, try watching it on the internet. The folks behind the Sideshow Network have launched a new YouTube channel called Wait For It. It's got interviews with comedians like Reggie Watts, Todd Glass, Liza Schlesinger, I've been friends with her for 10 years, one of the funniest people out there, and I still have a hard time with the last name, Liza. Our very own Owen Benjamin, that's me. takes you on a musical journey down internet rabbit holes and much more. You don't have to wait any longer. Just go to youtube.com/waitforitcomedy. There's no need to wait for it anymore because it's here and it's funny. And I love you.